committee. At my request, the speaker has removed all but three of us from the committee now for the rest of the session.
One at each end and one in the middle.
And so we can't hurt each other. So we will start as a subcommittee of the committee for the purpose of public hearing only to take a status report and some good news on House Bill 2780. So I'll open hearing on House Bill 2780. I think we'll even skip your part, Steve. Stakeholders to come up. Marcia, do you want to start?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Marcia Latta. I represent Salem Kaiser Public Schools, and we have requested House Bill 2780 to find a solution to a problem we were having with some student transportation. We've also found a solution with the help of the Department of Education. And with me is John Fairchild, our Department of Transportation Director, and Nancy Heiligman with the Department of Ed. They can explain the solution and the problem, or the issue.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Nancy Heiligman, Director of School Finance for the Department of Education. And we believe that with clarification in administrative rules, that the department can solve Salem's problem. What we really need to do is clarify existing practice in terms of the transportation reimbursement in the state school fund. We don't expect that this would make a significant difference in terms of dollars shifting among school districts. We think there will be very little impact.
Great.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Fairchild, the transportation director for Salem Public Schools. Again, simply to reiterate the comments that have already been made, we believe that it makes by far better sense where we can make a clear, clean distinction, ensuring that our determination for services are based on an academic component, ensuring that there is that kind of link without additional languages that get back to other parts of the rule that seem to be a little confusing, at least to me. So we certainly appreciate all the effort and certainly the committee's time for bringing this forward.
Well, anybody have any questions? I almost hate that. Representative Hess.
The shifts in this has, which evidently seems to affect higher district, higher, more populated areas, is that because of the efficiencies gained, or what causes that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Haas, the way that I expect the rule would be implemented, the reimbursement would apply to programs that are that have an academic component and are also for home to school purposes.
I guess what I want to clarify, though, is that the fix that you've achieved with your accommodation here is not the same fix that's reflected in the bill or the revenue impact or anything like that.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
I think that's great. They've solved their problem.
Yay!
Well, we'd like to talk to you about a parking lot.
I thought they were talking about baseball.
Okay, Mr. Fairchild.
I just wanted to make certain that, in fact, the information that you do have does include the Dash 1 amendment, so that would have been clear that what we talked about in the academic link was and home to school was clearly our intent.
Well, I guess my sense is I'm not too concerned even what the Dash 1 looks like. If you're all going to work it out without a bill, we will send you off with our fondest best wishes, and thanks for working that out.
Thank you.
Great. We will close the public hearing then on House Bill 2780, and let's mark that off the list of bills to talk about. Thank you. Are we ready to go on 3277? I guess we are. And let's go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 3277.
Do you have a hearing list of people?
Yeah, she's bringing it out. Okay, Steve, please give us the overview.
Okay, House Bill 3277 deals with what's called exception value.
What the bill is doing is identifying exception value and the school taxes on exception value. Exception value comes from changes in value either because of new construction, partitioning or subdividing property or rezoning property or amended property, or property that's disqualified from special assessment. Those exception events cause a reevaluation of the property, and the increase in the value of the property then is called the exception value, and the school tax on that exception value would be dedicated to capital projects. So it would be, the tax would be segregated and put in a separate fund for that purpose. 20% of any amount of that tax collected would have to go into a state fund and then could be distributed by the Department of Education to school districts for capital projects based upon application and criteria that the department would set up. The tax is identified in 1 year and then continues up to 5 years, and the tax then is not part of the school local revenue for the school equalization formula purposes. So it's kept outside the formula and then is dedicated for capital projects. The bill would not take effect until the 2003-2004 year when it would start, and then you would have a phasing in over that five-year period where the first year's tax on exception value would continue to be outside the formula for 5 years, and then the second year you would have a double effect to be outside, and so when you were fully phased in after 5 years, then you would add a year and drop a year in that process. I think that's the major points.
Okay. Enough to start taking up witnesses? Let's do then. We'll begin with Gary Conkling and Steve Berry. Scott Berry, sorry. You first? Oh, Scotty, okay.
Chair Shuttley and members of the committee, I'm Scott Berry with the Oregon Building Industry Association, and I'll pass out some written testimony, and I'll be fairly brief today. But House Bill 3277, which we introduced and, in fact, worked with a number of folks on towards the end of last session, captures the incremental increase in property values from construction, and dedicates that money, the school portion, to capital construction of schools. Currently, local government benefits from new construction when it moves into the area. Local government keeps those proceeds, that new money generated from the incremental increase, and our interest, frankly, is getting some of that incremental increase dedicated to school capital construction. So the money stays with the schools, but is dedicated towards the capital construction in those high-growth areas, which sorely need that those capital facilities. And with that, I will be happy to take any questions and turn it over to Mr. Conkling.
I'm going to take Gary's testimony next, and we'll open it up for questions then.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Gary Conkling, here today representing the Beaverton and Hillsborough School Districts in support of House Bill 3277. House Bill 3277 gives school districts and communities experiencing economic growth a valuable tool to help finance school facilities from new schools to major renovation of existing schools. In previous testimony, I've detailed the pressures on Beaverton and Hillsborough caused by rapid, relentless student enrollment growth. That pressure includes patron fatigue with repeated elections to approve huge bond measures, which, as you know, is the only source of revenue that we have to address capital needs. Our patrons ask why growth doesn't pay its fair share of the cost of new schools, and one reason is the state preemption of school impact fees, which are common in other states, and we've had the discussion about that before, and it generally stays as a discussion. Patrons also ask why the increased amount of property taxes generated by growth isn't used to build new schools, and explaining how the state school formula works to achieve equalization isn't a totally satisfying answer to this. The absence of financing tools and defensible answers to legitimate patron concerns led school officials, city officials, and developers in our community to sit down more than 2 years ago. And coincidentally, when Measure 50 passed and offered what appeared then and still does as a rational alternative, the growth increment, we brought forward that idea in the last session, and with the home builders' assistance have brought it forward again this session. What this approach does is effectively allows a school district to borrow the K-12 property taxes that are paid, currently paid, on new value in their community that stem from new construction, from upzoning, and additions to the urban growth boundary, without an offset in the state school formula. These property tax dollars would be reserved for capital improvements. After 5 years, these revenues would return to the formula calculation, and in this respect, the increment is similar to what currently goes on with urban renewal. And it's kind of an interesting side note that for urban renewal, the K-12 property taxes don't go to schools at all. In fact, they go to pay for infrastructure improvements as part of the urban renewal. So there already is a diversion of K-12 taxes on values that exist in communities. There has been a little direct criticism of this proposal. The chief concern is really one that what it does to depress the growth of local property tax revenues that are included in the state school formula calculation to fund K-12 schools. In practical terms, I would argue that this approach is less impactful on the total funds available for K-12 schools other than, say, for example, paying debt service for state-issued bonds out of the general fund. With the growth increment, target spending for schools will drive total funds, including increased state revenue, without any separate appropriations or legislative acts to pay for debt service. The other concern about the growth increment is that economic growth in a county doesn't automatically correlate with student enrollment increases. And while this is true, I think it misses the point that virtually all school districts in Oregon have long deferred capital needs. In the circumstances where communities may be growing without a lot of new students, the opportunity exists to use this revenue stream for renovation or even to replace older schools. I might add off of my testimony that I had lunch today with Tom Lynn Harris, and Tom and I have worked together in a number of issues, and I believe he will say something today, or perhaps will say something today, about some of the technical dimensions of the calculation, and we're sensitive to those. In fact, when former Representative Strobeck and I worked on this last session, We understood some of these issues. Mr. Meyer, your staff, worked with us. And I think there are some considerations that need to go into play about how you would actually calculate this. And I think there are some choices that you could make that both involve simplicity of the calculation as well as attempting to be as accurate as possible. Mr. Lynn Harris made me aware, and he can explain in more detail perhaps, some changes that assessors have that might pertain specifically to identification of exception value, or at least something that would approximate exception value. In any case, adding tools to finance school facilities cannot continue to be ignored by the state. The growth increment represents, in our view, a useful, effective tool that allows local school districts to use local property taxes generated by growth in their community to address local school needs. There's every reason to support the growth increment on its own merits. There may be even more reason to combine it with other tools to address an even wider set of needs and circumstances involving school capital requirements. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Questions for Mr. Conkling and Mr. Berry? Representative Kuforth.
Thank you. Gary, you said you reminded us that we had a bill similar to this last session in this committee. Is this bill different than the one that we had?
This one's 3277.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kapori, one of the differences is that this bill would go into effect not in this upcoming biennium, but in the subsequent biennium. So we did attempt to make it prospective so that it has no impact on the calculation of total funds for schools that we're all, I think, have debated. So we tried to make this a pure discussion about the potential of this technique as opposed to what its current impact would be. I think that's its most substantial change. I couldn't exactly attest. I believe that the calculation for the exception value may also be slightly different than it was before. And in fact, even last session, we were constantly refining our understanding of the data that was available. And I would submit, by the way, that we're not of the belief that we necessarily may have the right calculations. I think there are choices to make there that not only could impact the amount of money, but the clarity of what the value is that you're identifying on which to base this factor. I might just add one note. Keep in mind, this bill does not actually change any financial transaction. These are property tax dollars that today are generated and paid and that go for schools. What the change is, effectively, is that they aren't offset in the state school fund. So it's really a numerical calculation that is what this bill is about.
Gary, let me ask, I'm not at all insensitive to the problem that the high growth districts are facing, but can get within a finite pool of funds, can we make this better for one set of districts without making things correspondingly worse for others? And I say, for instance, the Falls City School District, and you've got a lot of them statewide, smaller districts that have declining enrollment, which sounds like things ought to be okay, but we know that under the school funding formula that presents significant problems for districts and their ability. And in communities that either many of them don't have the tax base to build a new school either, and it's simply because the tax base isn't big enough to realistically impose a tax on themselves to build a new school, or the school's falling down. It seems to me that, you know, to look at those districts, these dollars that would be captured and kept for school purposes are being kept for you know, certain limited school districts at the expense of other districts then who are going to be seeing fewer dollars come to them through the school funding formula, and they're going to say, gosh, thanks, what'd you do for us?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your question, and I understand it. There is a natural phenomenon.
Of course, that's operational money that's being cut on that side.
I understand. But it's a natural phenomenon that occurs in any case. Again, not to pick on Mr. Lynn Harris, who probably now wishes he didn't have lunch with me, but he was noting, for example, that with the Trojan nuclear plant, I'm sure he'll remedy that problem. But when the Trojan nuclear plant's closure, they're experiencing in the Rainier area a substantial decrease in assessed value as that property, I don't know what its exact exit is from the tax rolls, whether it's depreciated equipment or what schedule it's on. But when that happens, that's under the current phenomenon. It draws more dollars from the state into those districts to achieve the target for funding of students. So we have a phenomenon where there already is movement. You all are more familiar than me with how assessment works for industrial properties. It's not all on a trend line up. In fact, industrial properties as often as not can go down. So we have a phenomenon of where there are rises and falls in our assessed value, even as we're looking at it. The premise in this bill is to look at aggregate amounts. We're really trying to capture, in broad terms, a proxy for increased value in a community as a reference point of saying the taxes generated by that, the K-12 taxes in this particular case, generated on those values, ought to be able to be used, even in a short period of time, to create a revenue stream to essentially invest in equity of capital facilities. It's going to come somewhere. Our district in Beaverton had to make the choice of not going for a local option that would have paid for additional programs, additional teachers, because we had to go to the voters to ask for more than $150 million to build schools that still are too large, that still are full the day that we have them. We, in fact, are substituting operating dollars for capital facilities now by virtue of the fact that we don't have the tools to address our capital needs. So whether it's through the natural movements of property assessed value changes or our own fact that we just have the pressures to deal with, and if you have to have a portable, you pay for it the same way and out of the same budget as you pay for a teacher, I think those are just things that are part of the system. This doesn't cure them. I'm not sure that it necessarily makes them worse, but I think that, in fact, it does capture a particular value that is a useful reference point for us to use as a revenue stream for capital.
But didn't Measure 5 intentionally divorce value from school property tax base for school funding?
Measure 5.
You're reducing it to that $5 per thousand. I mean, you don't get to keep all that. And Measure 50 then too. You don't get to keep all that. That's just the way it works.
No question about that. And Mr. Chair, I was remiss in not noting one other thing to respond to your question of the equalization issue. This was something that was done in the Smart Growth and Commerce Committee, and the bill was amended in a gross bill to include a 20% pool that's intended as a statewide pool, so that districts that may have a need but not have the growth, the exception value growth, could in fact have some source of revenue themselves for capital needs. So that's at least an attempt to respond to that issue.
I want to share. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gary, have you thought about how this bill might fit in some way with the bill that the Treasurer brought to this committee a couple of weeks ago? I think it was House Bill 3370 that provided for a statewide system of trying to address school construction needs through general obligation bonds.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, in fact, my last paragraph of my testimony was meant to suggest that just that kind of combination might make sense, that presumably you could look at state-issued general obligation bonds perhaps as the tool to assist districts that don't have growth, whereas you might look at this tool as a way and also a bondable way to deal with capital facility needs. I think that it would make sense, incidentally, to contemplate the possibility of not necessarily having each and every school district go out and try to bond these particular growth increment bonds, which will have property tax support behind them and so should be fairly good quality, but in fact having a statewide bonding facility for this kind of a pool I think would make some sense, and so I would agree the combination of those two might produce a nice package to respond to a mix of needs.
Anybody else? Representative Harris.
Mr. Chair, just in the fall city scenario, I think your point would be is accurate if there were 100 fewer students in Fall City versus 100 more in Beaverton, but the numbers are just so much more heavy on the Beaverton side, and I just don't think that people appreciate the incredible growth that Beaverton has. I've seen in terms of additional students coming every year. I think it's something like 8,000. Do you know how many schools have been built since 1990 in Beaverton Hillsborough?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hass, I apologize I don't have the numbers of schools down, but in my testimony that I gave in support of HDR 46 and House Bill 3370, I noted that in the last decade, the Beaverton School District alone had approved something in excess of $400 million of bonds, local bonds for schools, and the consolidated bonded indebtedness was now more than $6.12, as I recall. I don't recall the total number of schools, but you can appreciate that's a fair number.
$6.12 per thousand?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's hear from Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jerry Crummell, State Representative, District House District 27, and I'm one of those, my district is one of those very fast, high-growth districts that we all love to hate because they take more money. I think one of the things about House Bill 3277, and I'd like to just address one of the questions that you had with regards to high-growth districts versus no-growth districts. I think there's a little bit of a misunderstanding that when more students come to a school district that just automatically means more money, and it does on the operations side. But when the school district is looking to try to figure out how they're going to construct new schools, and especially if they're in an area that the voters are telling them to stay within existing resources, it becomes a little bit on the tough side. We've been very fortunate in Westland, Wilsonville, and Tigard, Tualatin, and Sherwood in that the voters have approved bond levies for construction of schools. On the other hand, there are some other districts around the state that are not quite so fortunate. As I looked at this idea of using exception value, and having been the chair of an urban renewal district, I know how much exception value can be helpful, and how you can really it can really create an exceptional, no pun intended, number of dollars for you to be able to for a district to be able to utilize. And I think that if we tried to go with an SDC, we wouldn't see the type of dollars being generated that we can generate through an exception type of tax. with regards to the no or low growth districts or a declining district, you're right, they still have needs. And that's one of the reasons why in the bill we put the provision in of the 20% statewide fund that school districts could go to as a means for getting either part of or potentially even all of their construction costs covered if they're doing a remodeling or retrofitting or any number of other things that might be needed by their district. I think our school districts are very troubled with the fact that there's had to be so much delayed type of construction, or not construction, but maintenance on the buildings. And I know this is true in Portland, it's true in John Day, it's true in Pendleton, it's true pretty much all over the state. So I think that this is a way that we can provide not only a state fund, but also we can help the high growth districts be able to get the facilities that they need to teach all the kids that are coming to their schools. I think one of the things that we need to recognize with regards to property taxes, and let's not forget, is that high growth districts and high value districts also tend to be transferring dollars out of their districts. They tend to be loaner districts. They're transferring dollars out of their districts into districts because of the statewide formula. And it's not a direct transfer, I understand, but what it is that because of the amount of property tax that they're able to generate, they don't get as much on the state income tax side. So that then the state, more of the state income tax, and so it is a de facto trade-off in that respect. I would like to call your attention to the -A4 amendments. One of the things that was supposed to have occurred when the bill was originally amended in Commerce was that, and it just didn't get from my brain onto the paper and then over to Legislative Council. So we had to fix that. But the -A4s. Relate to the urban renewal districts, and what it does is two things. And I sat down with the League of Oregon Cities and we discussed this, and I believe that they will come up and say something to the effect of that, you know, they're neutral on the bill, or you know, they don't want to be a resounding yes necessarily, but they understand the need. But what the A4s will do is it will make the bill prospective as far as urban renewal districts are concerned. So it will only affect urban renewal districts that go into effect after the effective date of the act.
Now, do you mean existing urban renewal districts? Or
no.
Window urban renewal districts?
Urban renewal
non-existing urban renewal districts.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Urban renewal districts that are adopted after the effective date. And then the other thing that it does is that it takes the money, because right now, in an urban renewal district, school districts don't get anything from the urban renewal district. When an urban renewal district is formed, the dollars are kept in, all of the dollars are kept for every taxing district are kept in the urban renewal district. Those dollars are not sent anywhere else. What this would do is allow for, is amend the statute so that the urban renewal district would actually split the money with the school district on a 50-50 basis.
On the increment value.
On the increment, only on the increment value, yes. And then the other thing that it would do is that it would still provide that the... that's a heck of a pager.
That's a cardinal sin.
Got to turn it off, sorry.
I'm so ashamed.
I move we vote Representative Bates off the island.
He's already off the island.
In picking up where I left off, Mr. Chair, the other thing that the Dash A4s will allow, besides the 50% staying with the school district, is that there's still, it still allows for all of the monies reflected by a school district to go into the statewide fund. So what we're really trying to do is take dollars from growth, which is one of the biggest complaints of the local school districts, is that when they have growth, that growth doesn't pay for itself. And this is a way that growth absolutely will pay for itself, in terms of providing facilities for schools that, or school districts that are needing the facilities to be able to meet the demand. I think that, 3277, with the A4s added in, and I, as I mentioned, I want to make sure that it's on the record that I support those, is a good common sense way that we can help the schools with regards to some of the construction needs that they have, and not only help the high growth districts, but we can help the school districts statewide. The other thing about the bill is that it will, although, you know, and I understand that, you know, some folks would like to try to spend the money twice. What I found is, you know, I've never been able to figure out how I can do that. But one of the things that it does is that by holding it out from operations, we make sure that school districts have money available that will be available for them to utilize to be able to for the maintenance and construction needs that they might have. In my district alone, my school district, there was $172 million of new construction growth in the Westland Wilsonville School District in the year 2000. You multiply that times 5%. That is, or five times $5. That's a bucket load of money that could be used both at the statewide level as well as at the local level for constructing these facilities that are needed so badly. With that, I will close. Mr. Chair, thank you very much for allowing me to come and testify today. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Any questions for Representative Crummell? Maybe while you're here, Steve, we don't have in here, and I wonder if you've got or if you're working on, what would be the revenue impact of this, either to the districts or to the general, or to the state funding formula, the general fund, I guess, over the next 4 years, 6 years?
Mr. Chair, we're in the process of working on a number. I would expect that number to be between 25 to 50 million in the first year, double that in the second year, and so on until you're through the full five-year phase in.
When you mean double, so on, do you mean doubles every year?
The 25, if it were 25 million mm-hmm. in the first year, mm-hmm. it would continue to be that 25 million in the next 4 years. And then in the second year, you would have additional exception value. And if that were the same level, you'd have that 25 in the second year.
Okay.
So the second year would be 50, third year 75.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Lori Wimmer and Tricia Smith, why don't we bring you up together? Objection? No. You may.
Good afternoon, committee members. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen with the Oregon Education Association. We are opposed to this bill. Many of you won't find that surprising because you've either heard me testify on this in another committee in this session or in the Revenue Committee in 99. You'll be getting my written testimony. I won't read it to you. I'll just hit a couple high points. We have seen revenue impacts that show over a five-year period quite a significant hundreds of millions of dollars of what I like to call SDCs that the other districts pay. And the reason I say that is that if you consider the total operating expenses of all the school districts in the state, and you back out the local share for those high growth districts, that means the amount of state share either has to compensate for it or there'll be less general fund revenue appropriated in those years. if we have the quality education model in place at any point, directing and costing what it is we're choosing to spend on K-12, and it becomes less and less of a political number and more of a mathematically derived or policy derived number, if that number is a fixed cost, then the general fund will be backfilling this very gigantic offset ban. And we just can't imagine future legislatures having the will or the capacity to do that. So in effect, then, it is the SDCs that all other districts pay. We also believe that the scheme is mechanically flawed, and you heard some reference to that earlier. If a retirement community or a resort community also experiences high growth, they will get the dollars in and get to keep it offset from the offset ban, but they won't have necessarily fast-growing student populations. They have fast-growing property value. That's not necessarily equal. And what happens in that particular scenario, say a resort community, let's take Lincoln County, for example. They're closing schools right now. They've got such a declining enrollment problem. It would seem to me a misfit of the intention of the authors to send money to a declining enrollment district. But that could happen the way this is proposed. So we think it's mechanically flawed as well. We do believe that high growth is a legitimate, serious problem, and we do want to work on remedies. We were very much in favor of the state treasurer's general obligation bond proposals that you all passed out of here recently. We're very much in favor of an equitable local option policy. Oregon Education Association is even in favor of some form of an SDC, should that be the will of the people or this body. But we don't necessarily think that this is the way to get the job done. I would say also that the fact that it's deferred to a future biennium is a device that's been tried on a number of policy issues this session. And as I've said before, just knowing that the train is coming in advance doesn't make the pain hurt any less. So with that, I'll take any questions if you have them.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. I represent classified school employees in more than half of the districts in the state, much more than half. I can't remember right now. And we agree with Oregon Education Association and many of the points that they made, but my testimony, I would like to take you on a bit of a different tack. And that is the mechanics of the A. N. Gross Bill 3277 in sections 2 through 2D. We believe that this is a very interesting concept that may not affect the state school fund necessarily, but definitely is a situation where growth is paid for by other districts. And in some cases, money is taken from districts that are not experiencing growth in student populations, but are experiencing growth in buildings, and sends it to other districts. Sections 2 through 2D describe how this money comes to the fund and how it comes out of the fund. Essentially what happens is the assessor determines how much property is valued at, and then determines how much the growth has increased the value of that property. And it's growth in a property. So if a subdivision is built on land, they determine the exception value of that subdivision or the properties within that subdivision, or a shopping center or whatever it is that's created the growth in the property value. At that point, then, the assessor determines what the exception value is, that is the difference between the original value and the new value, and then determines what the operating taxes on that exception value is or are, and then determines what 20% of the operating taxes of the exception value is. That money, that 20% of the operating taxes of that school district, then goes to the state. So local property tax revenues are transferred to the state treasurer under this bill and go into a new fund called the School Capital Project Fund. In Ms. Wimmer Whalen's example in Lincoln County, the 20% of the growth value of the operating taxes of the growth value in Lincoln County School District would then go to the state into this fund, and the Department of Education would, by rule, develop criteria for school districts to use to apply for grants back out of that fund for capital projects. So if you're a school district that has, that is experiencing growth in property value but not growth in student population, 20% of the operating taxes of the growth value is going to go to the state fund. You have to show then the Department of Education that you need capital projects in your school district to get your money back, or a portion of your money back. And it will be based upon the criteria determined by the Department of Education, and assuming that you have needs, your capital needs. There's nothing in this bill that says you get your money back. There's nothing in this bill that says if you get some of your money back, that you get all of your money back. So essentially what this does is what Ms. Wimmer-Whalen expressed to you, and that is that in many cases, districts will be paying for growth in other districts. And they will be doing it in a very unique way in my experience in this building. It's, we're not arguing now about whether or not state money that should go to one district will now go to another district. What we're arguing in this bill is that property taxes that are assessed in one district will go to the state and then go out to another district. I'm curious about whether or not someone has examined the legality of taking local property tax revenue through a piece of legislation, putting it in a state fund with a state agency then determining who gets it. I would think state, local, or that local property tax value for school districts needs to remain within the school district, and then the school district can determine how to allocate those funds. We certainly are sympathetic to the needs of school districts that are experiencing high growth. We are very supportive of finding a mechanism that will allow that growth to pay for the needs that occur in school districts in those areas. We never, though, will support a bill that takes local property tax money from one school district through whatever mechanism and gives it to another school district to deal with their needs, because each school district in the state has its own set of needs, and I haven't heard any of them say they have enough money now and they can afford to share. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Representative Witt?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This idea of local property tax revenue staying within the local district, that may be technically true, but isn't that really a myth because of equalization and the way the state money comes in on top of that and gets mixed and spread throughout the entire state? If that is true, that the local property tax revenue truly stays within the district, then it should also be true that the state apportions money from state tax revenues in a very unequal manner to the various school districts around the state. Isn't that true?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wett, I would agree with you that that is true. I don't believe that the state allocates equal dollars to each school district because it offsets state dollars based on local revenues today. So if my school district raises more in local revenues than your school district does, my school district will get less state funding than yours will.
That's correct. Thank you. So follow up, Mr. Chairman. So based on that analysis, the equalization formula and the way it is used per ADMW really creates an economic myth to this reality that the local property taxes stay within the local district. Isn't that true?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I would not agree with that statement. I believe the local property taxes do stay within the district. How much money the state gives the district may vary depending upon that amount.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. If that is true, and I accept the fact that technically the local property tax revenue stays within the local district. But in reality, the legislature, in the way it funds schools through the school equalization formula, takes directly into account the local property tax dollars that quote-unquote stay within the district, determining how much state money to give. So from an economic standpoint, this idea that this money is sacrosanct and stays within the local district, from an economic standpoint, it's false. It's just a false reality, because in reality, the state immediately adjusts what it gives to equalize those dollars.
There is
no, Mr. Chair, Representative Wood, there is no question that there is an offset of those dollars, and the state accounts for that, and it is one of the many myths that surround the school funding formula today. My point in saying this, however, was that this is a piece of legislation which specifically and directly takes local property tax dollars and gives it to the state to allocate as it chooses.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, that's exactly my point. The state already does that. It might not do it in a direct technical sense by taking that money away from Beaverton or Hillsborough or Portland or any other school district, but in reality it does, because it adjusts how much money that each district gets on a per-student basis based upon the offsets of the state money and how they get apportioned through the various school districts.
I guess we could argue.
Well, it doesn't.
I mean, it does actually disagree.
It does that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Frank McNamara. I represent COSA. I'm here today because Ozzie Rose is out of town, and we did want to have some comment on record regarding the bill, which we oppose. And there are two simple issues that we would want to lift up for your concern and consideration. One is our concern about the floating number that is related to what is the impact, what is the impact in the next biennium, and what is the impact over 5 years. And we've heard numbers now from $25 million in the first biennium and prior to today up to 50-some million in the first biennium that it takes effect, and now I see a number here of $575 million in the next biennium. I don't quite understand that number, but it's a significantly different number than the 25 that your legislative staff just provided, and we're concerned.
We deny it?
Okay. Well, we're certainly concerned about the fact that you would be making decisions having no real knowledge about what the number is that you're talking about of the impact on the tax situation for local districts and for state funds. And we heard even today, I think, the representative prior to our coming forward apparently pointing out yet another discovered impact that hadn't been determined. I suspect we'll find many more as we examine the bill, or if it becomes law, and we have to deal with it. So that concern about the floating number, the potential cost, is one of the issues we would raise. And the other is I was going to look at the earlier number, but looking at $575 million is more than $890 per ADMW. That's a significant impact. We do believe that this is money that then, at least partially, the state will need to be making up as that increment grows over the five-year period. As was pointed out by Mr. Conkling, these are taxes that are already collected and paid today, and would not be collected and paid in the same manner in the future. And we think that will have an impact on what the state requirement is to backfill on that revenue. And we are our concerns are congruent with those that were expressed by OEA. Thank you.
All right. Any questions for Mr. McNamara?
I have a question actually for Ms. Wimmer, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
You used the phrase SDCs that other districts pay. Can you explain to me what you mean by that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Witt, I thought I had said that because, in effect, if you figure on an ADMW basis, what the value of that tax increment is over the five-year period, the total, whether we're talking, you know, $25 million or $400 million or whatever that five-year value would be, we're talking about how much money comes out of the classroom per, on a per-student basis, or we're backfilling it with general fund dollars. And I just strongly feel that we're not being candid if we don't say that. We don't believe there is that much money available to backfill. And so, in effect, then, it comes out of future appropriations to all the other school districts that aren't going to get to keep their offset.
If I can follow up, Mr. Chairman, but isn't it true that the legislature makes the determination as to how much, in terms of state revenues, to put into K-12 funding?
Mr. Chair and Representative Witt, they do, but within the bounds of what capacity the state has to fund that.
If I can follow up, Mr. Chairman, this phrase, STCs that other districts pay, I mean, wouldn't it be appropriate to also, I mean, if that's the analysis we're giving to this, to also say that when one district, because it has significantly greater property value on a per-student basis than other district, and because of the way the equalization is done through the state appropriation, through the formula, isn't it equally true to say that these districts that have higher property values on a per-student basis are supplementing operating funds to support other districts?
Representative Shively, Representative Witt, yes, I think that it is. And I think that the Oregon tax system is a redistributive tax system, and I think that this is just one example of that. I didn't write the tax code, but that's the way I see it operating on all kinds of levels, that the wealthier areas of the state subsidize all sorts of services all over the state.
Okay, so don't you think it's appropriate that the way 3277 calls for growth in essence to pay for its own costs? In terms of school renovation or construction, isn't that logical? Because you're using the dollars that are coming directly from that growth to pay for those costs associated with growth.
Mr. Chair and Representative Witt, I believe that those dollars are already paying for other things, and that the shifting the deck chairs on the Titanic is not what the OEA could support as a way to catch up with that growth. We would rather see new money created to do that.
So you don't think it's appropriate then to let the growth pay for itself?
Mr. Chair and Representative Witt, I absolutely do think growth should pay for itself, and that's why we support SDCs.
You don't think this bill has growth paying for itself? It takes the property taxes of that growth to use to pay for the consequences of growth.
Mr. Chair and Representative Witt, we do not see it that way.
Representative Bates.
I'm going to try to phrase my questions to make sure I understand this bill so I understand why I'm going to vote the way I'm going to vote. If we ever get to it.
You already voted yesterday.
And I may be changing the vote the way I voted last time, too, because I'm getting
that
the understanding here.
Practice vote.
In essence, what we're talking about is local taxes are going to be going up over the years, and especially in high-growth areas. And the way our school formula works, that if you take that chunk of incremental growth out and use it locally for capital improvements, 20% going to state fund. If you don't, in fact, end up, is that wrong?
No.
If you don't, in fact, at that time increase the general fund for the schools to make up that difference, you're decreasing the entire general fund, and that's the point you're trying to make here, I believe. Okay. So in essence, you're in a position, if the legislature says we are going to make up that difference and keep funding at its present or even a higher level and hold all districts harmless, that would be a different story, but it could potentially mean a huge increase in general funds going into public education if this is a significant amount of capital being pulled out. And your fear, I assume, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the state will not continue to fund any higher than it is now, which means the general fund is now going heavier into certain districts which have had a big incremental growth and no longer going to the entire state. And we do recognize that we are redistributing funds within the system. A kid that is born in Burns or born in town of Phoenix or born in an area that has low values, low property values, we want that child to have the same opportunity for an education as a kid who's born into a very rich district. And that's one of the principles we've based our education system on, an equal education system for all students. Recognizing that in areas like Washington County where salaries are high, where people have a high education, they have an obligation, or at least we think they do have an obligation, to have an opportunity for all children in the state to have an equal opportunity for the public education system. We will not have a system of haves and have-nots. A kid born in Coos Bay does not have the same opportunities or close to the same opportunities as a child born in Washington County. And that's just an example. And I think that's the basis of this argument and the philosophy of this argument, if I've got it right. Am I incorrect in anything I've said?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bates, I couldn't have said it better. Thank you.
And doesn't this session kind of present that issue of redistribution in a different light, too, with the federal forest money coming in? Because I know we're hearing from those districts that would benefit handsomely, some of them outlandishly, you might say, from the federal forest receipts if they were to be distributed strictly according to the federal legislation. That the hue and cry we're hearing from those districts is that by running that money
treating that as local revenue, running through the formula that we are redistributing from those districts to districts that would not benefit otherwise from those federal forest funds.
Mr. Chair, if I can comment on that also. Yeah. My county, the area I come from, would benefit from the forest coming, the forest reserves coming directly to us. And I have argued for that money going into the general formula on the basis of fairness. Mm-hmm. Just as Washington County or areas like that are actually subsidizing other areas, I think we have a responsibility. If we want equal opportunity for kids in the state to have an equal education, we have to be honest about it and put that money back in, too.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, if I could comment on your question as well. I believe that there is a difference in the way House Bill 3277 addresses the issue of redistribution and what you're redistributing and whether or not it's appropriate for you to redistribute this, in that it is dealing with locally generated property tax revenues that the property taxpayers in your school districts have determined for themselves, or the level, assuming that that Measure 5 didn't come in there somewhere and help them make that decision. At any rate, whether there's a local option or however they've determined their property tax base, they've determined their property tax base to the extent that they can under the Constitution. House Bill 3277 is the legislature determining that local property taxes generated within a district should be taken from that district, regardless of whether they have growth needs within the school district or other needs. Money is taken from the district and put in a fund in Salem and then reallocated back out to school districts based on student need. So if a district has, I would submit to you that in a two-year period there is some growth somewhere in virtually every school district. That's not the same as a high-growth school district. It is growth within the boundaries of a school district, and that's what this bill deals with. Not only the districts that have high population growth needs, like Washington County school districts. So a school district that has growth in property value within the district loses money under this bill. Every district that has growth in value within that district loses money into this fund. They only get it back if they have high growth needs that require capital construction in the school district capital construction. So if it is a district that has a new industrial park and they're siting an industry in that industrial park, they're going to experience value. Whether or not they get money back through this bill depends upon when and if they reach a point where they need to build a new school. So we believe that this is different because it's local money coming to the state and then going somewhere else.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bates?
I would argue that that's one of the pluses of this bill. Let me tell you why. I'll give you an example. In my area, in the Center Point School District, is located in the industrial heart of the Medford area. When a new plant goes in, they get the money. Most of the people that support those plants work there are in my district, across the line from that. They get nothing from that new funds rolling in, and yet our district has to educate all those kids. So they have an equal point on one side, some point on the other. Putting that money into a general fund, which you can draw back from, I don't have any problem with. Okay? So it's a redistribution formula again. Okay? What I have a problem with this bill is what it does with the general fund, and that's why I would oppose it. But I think we need to be honest about these things in our debates and say what, you know, not try to game it, but really be honest about where that money is going, how it's going, and what its full impact is. And that's what I'm trying to get to here. And I'm doing that respectfully. I understand your point, but I can think of exceptions that we get into trouble immediately. And we've got a real problem with school districts that are growing exceedingly fast who need help in building new schools. Just raising the money through a levy all the time from the school does not cover the cost of opening those new schools up and putting the materials in those new schools and all the difficulty they have maintaining the school. So I have sympathy for what's going on there. It's a difficult problem.
Okay. Thank you very much. Michael Gay, let's bring you up here.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Michael Gay. I'm actually a resident of Tigard, constituent of Representative Williams, here to testify on behalf of Representative Starr, who was unable to make it to the hearing this morning. Also, I'd like to apologize perhaps for the excessive flamboyance of my outfit today. If I would not have been testifying, I would have worn something a little more sedate, but hopefully this won't detract from the thoughts of my representative.
Is there a practice sign need eye party tonight, Michael, that no one told us about?
Not to my knowledge, but okay. Mr. Chair Williams, if there is, I'd certainly like to be informed of it. The Hillsborough School District, which is in Representative Starr's district, is one of the fastest growing school districts in the state right now. Unfortunately, it also has one of the largest average class sizes in the state, and in part because we're unable to build school buildings and classrooms fast enough as people come into the district. Plus, to finance those extra buildings, we have to continue to go back to local voters and ask them to pass bonds and increase their property tax, and that's not always a positive thing with the voters. Many people are under the mistaken impression that when you have rapid growth in a local district, you receive increased revenue. That is not necessarily the case. Since the passage of Measure 5, local property tax serves as an offset to state support, so additional growth brings nothing but more students, not more local dollars, local tax dollars. Some people also think additional students means we receive additional amounts from the state. That's partly true. We receive an additional amount for each enrolled student, but that covers only operating costs, not capital construction costs. For years, we have been looking for a way to have growth pay for some of the impact it has on local school districts. System development charges for SDCs simply add to the cost of the already high cost of housing in fast-growing counties. But HB 3277 presents a viable solution for this problem, which has the support of Representative Starr's local school districts as well as the home builders. And it does not remove any money from the existing state school fund. Under Measure 50, when there is new development, the property is appraised at a new value. House Bill 3277 proposes to take the difference between the current value and the new value on newly developed property and divert the school tax portion of the local property tax to the school district for a period of 5 years to be used exclusively for capital projects, either new construction, remodeling, or repairs. After 5 years, the local property tax value would then, of course, return to the current system. This plan finally addresses the issues of growth, new development, with increasing numbers of students, and a way to help school districts pay for the cost of absorbing those students. Past legislators have been frustrated by the need to find some way to help local school districts cope with the problems of facilities and construction. Representative Starr believes House Bill 3277 is a creative way to accomplish that challenge without upsetting our current distribution system. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to attempt to answer them.
Any questions? Okay, we'll hope to find your party.
Thanks.
I'm always in trouble. I'm sure in need of a party.
Yeah. Okay, let's bring up the techno guys, John Phillips and Tom Lynn Harris. Committee, this is the last testimony we have today. For those of you who are late, we already dispatched House Bill 2780. And we will not be taking up 3770.
Mr. Chairman, where did you dispatch it to?
They came in and told us that they got it all settled. They don't need a bill. Okay. Not to put any pressure on you for
that's
challenge.
Their problem.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Tom Linares. I'm the Columbia County Assessor, and I'm here today representing the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. I suppose the first line of my testimony could be, hi, I'm from the county assessor's office, and I'm here to help you. Obviously, county assessors don't have any issue with the policies regarding whether taxes on exception value should be or should not be used to offset the school funding formula. That certainly is not within our area of expertise or policy considerations. As the people who will be doing the calculations, however, we are concerned that whatever is finally decided in the bill is something that county assessors can understand and can calculate accurately and consistently throughout the state. The last thing I want to do is have arguments with my superintendents every year about whether I calculated their exception value high enough or not. So, and it's always frustrating to me, when I speak with Gary Conkling and others about exception value,
us too,
and legislators about why it is we have so much problem calculating exception value. I mean, it seems so cut and dried and simple. You have a piece of bare land and somebody builds a house on it, it's the value of the new house. What's so difficult about that? Well, there's all kinds of complications to that which makes it difficult. Since 97, when Measure 50 was first passed, and part of the problem, I think, stems back to 97. If you'll remember, ballot Measure 50 was passed by the voters in May of 97. The 100-plus bill implementing ballot Measure 50 was not passed until early July, and we had to get the rollout the following October. So every county scrambled as best they could to set their computer systems up to get the roll turned that first year, and even though there's been improvements and modifications and corrections to that first year's computer programming, I think most counties are still pretty much stuck with the basic outline of the computer system that they designed so quickly back in 97. Most of the data that is provided, that Mr. Meyer, your staff, has been using, is provided through the Summary of Assessment Levy report that each county provides to the Department of Revenue every year. This is a report that's comprised of 15 or 16 tables displaying data every which way you can think of, including three separate tables just on exception value, none of which is probably real consistent statewide for a variety of reasons. There has been a working group that has been meeting for about 6 months to revise those tables, and although we're not quite finished with our work, we hope to combine the three tables dealing just with exception value into a single table. And rather than calling it exception value, we are instead calling it growth in value from four different sources. The one source being those properties that are assessed at RMV, not the maximum assessed value under Measure 50, so it could go up 20% a year or go down 20% a year. It's not limited by that 3% growth because it's being assessed at RMV. The second factor would be those properties that are being assessed at maximum assessed value, and the only thing that happens is they grow the allowable 3%, which is probably more than 50% of the tax account statewide. The other would be sort of the exception value piece. Any property that grew more than 3% from the prior year, and how much was that amount over 3%? And then a fourth category of just being miscellaneous, because properties go up something less than 3%, a whole variety of things. So we're hoping that will solve the state's data collection problem and get a little bit more consistent piece of information that can be used. That is different than the calculation of exception value in House Bill 3277. I've got some real questions and concerns about how the language is written, including one little techno piece that, if I'm right, means that no district would have any exception value, because the calculation would always end up with a negative number. If I'm right, then that's all. You just need to switch A and B around so that you're starting with a higher number and deducting the lower number to come out with a positive number. I did talk to Gary Conklin at lunch today. There's a question about whether the...
Who paid for it?
Gary,
yeah, did pay for it.
We went Dutch.
Oh.
Good. There's a question of whether the calculation is made on an account-by-account basis or the total taxing district or school district basis. And that may seem like a simple thing, but it makes a huge, huge difference in the number that's ultimately arrived at. If you use the district, then you factor in those properties that go down in value by a considerable amount, so you're offsetting the increase of other properties. If it's on a property-by-property basis, and the bill says only the positive amount, so you throw out any account that went down in value, and with what you're left is a number that's probably even higher than what Mr. Meyer has estimated. So, I mean, those things are... I mean, there's some huge swings. I told Mr. Meyer the exception value under this bill is either zero or twice what he's estimated, you know, depending on how you interpret. And I don't want to get into those nitty-gritty whether A should be before B or vice versa.
Yeah.
But I would hope that perhaps Mr. Meyer and maybe Dexter Johnson and John Phillips and Gary, I mean, if the bill goes forward, I think somebody, I mean, some techno people like us need to really spend some time figuring out and making sure that the number isn't a negative number, which is not going to produce the results you guys want.
Okay. John?
John Phillips of the Department of Revenue, Property Tax Division. Thank you. I'm just going to kind of pick up where Tom left off and just say a few words about the mechanics of this, kind of at the technical level also. But I think the definitions are critical. We talk about exception value, and it is thought that there is exception value that's capturable. And I've spent a lot of time this week just talking to counties and with different systems, because there are 12 different software systems in the 36 counties, and about 5 or 6 of those are just sort of homegrown. They're just related to that county only. They were developed over a period of years just for that county. Their definitions of what they've called things in the process and their interpretation of Measure 50 is maybe different from what some company in Texas developed for 6 or 7 counties also. So there is a lot of variation out there. And we are responsible for sort of overseeing all that, but what we require of them is to follow the law and calculate the taxes correctly. What's not required under the law is that they report certain specific data elements. And so when Tom talks about getting mishmash of information on which to base estimates, that's because while they may be calculating Measure 50 correctly on an account-by-account basis, they're not able to report that data. In the programming scurry that occurred in 97, there was no time to just commit programming time to those efforts. So we just have not been able to get good data. If you want to do that, we can work on that, but that's a programming issue. So saying exception value is what you are saying it is in the bill is different from really what's out there. And so that would be some kind of an effort to determine that separately. The bill also requires a comparison of that value, whatever that is, against a what would have been value. Those are the words used in the bill, what would have been. So just so that you're aware, that would require a separate calculation on each individual account as to what would have been had an exception not occurred on that account. And I'm referring to, if you're interested, Section 2. If I can find it.
Line
11 on page 1, the assessed value of the property, what the assessed value would have been under or would have under 308.146 sub 2 or any other partial or special exemption would have been applicable. So I just wanted to point out that it's a would have been calculation necessitates additional calculations. I'm not 100% clear on this, but I think the language in the distribution schedule, which is it's on page 2, section 2B sub 2. The distribution schedule is a schedule that once all taxes are computed for all the districts, then the money is dumped into a pot and then distributed to all those districts based on the percentage. And I think what this bill is doing, I'm not sure, it's if you take your monthly income and you divide it by all the things you need to spend it on, housing, food, entertainment, et cetera, and it all equals the amount that you get. And then from the food, you say, well, I really should commit about 20% of that to vitamins, but you don't actually get any more income, then you're distributing more than 100% of your income to your expenses. And I think what this section's doing is distributing more than 100% of the tax dollars. So I just want to think maybe we can work on that, but just the wording I don't think gets us there. So just a couple words of caution.
Well, maybe we won't go into work session on this today then.
oh, really?
Okay, no, I appreciate that. That's good stuff. That's good stuff.
A conceptual amendment right here.
A conceptual amendment.
And a moot bill.
I'm in committee. I'm sorry. I have Brian Reeder who is here
with
one bit more of information for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Brian Reeder from the Department of Education. I'd just like to go on record saying that the department likes the negative exception value proposal put forth by Tom Lindner. It would solve our problems with this bill. The department does oppose this bill, and for many of the reasons that previous witnesses have indicated. What this bill does is does a couple things that we think is not good for many districts in the state. In effect, it takes what are currently operating revenues and requires that they be spent for capital projects. And it also, in doing that, redistributes those monies, which are currently operating monies, to districts that have the highest growth in exception value. Now, the paper that Paul's handing out is something that I put together this morning based on data from the Department of Revenue. Before you get too far into it, you'll need to note that four counties are not represented here because they have not reported their exception value to the department yet. Those counties are Benton, Lane, Lynn, and Marion. What this shows, though, is that every school district in the state has exception value. And I think if you look at the top of the second page, you'll find Rainier, which was mentioned earlier, substantial exception value, even though they've got declining enrollment. They would be required under this bill to dedicate that money to capital projects, when in fact they may not have any capital projects that they want to do. They sorely need operating revenue, and this prevents them from using that money for operating revenue. At the same time, it reduces the amount of operating revenue that they get through the formula, because we have taken money that currently is distributed through the formula for operating purposes and says it must be used for capital. On the third page, about the 12th one down, you find Fall City. They're in the same situation. They've got 3.5% of their total value in 2000-2001 was exception value. Again, they're required to spend it on capital. They send 20% of it off. They keep 80% of it. That 80% they must spend on capital projects. The 20% they're not likely to get back. That money's going to districts with capital needs. That's the primary point I want to make here, is that we are, in fact, redistributing operating money, forcing it to be spent as capital, and sending it away from districts that sorely need operating revenue and may have no capital needs at all. Another point that hasn't been made yet is that we, under Measure 5, we have a $5 per thousand limit on operating taxes for schools. This bill would take some of that $5 and say it has to be used for capital. We've, in essence, shrunk down the Measure 5 limit to something below $5 per thousand of market value and said you can only raise 4.5 or 4 because that money is now dedicated to capital expenditures. I think that concludes my remarks.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
Thank you. Isn't it true that all districts have capital needs requirements that develop over time?
That is, I'm not willing to say that all districts have capital needs. Many districts now with declining enrollment have maintenance needs that are quite severe, which may not fall into a capital category. It, over long periods of time, yeah, you probably could argue that any district, whether they're declining or growing, has some sort of capital needs. That's true. Under current law, they are perfectly able to use operating money for those capital needs as they choose. They're not forced to put aside money for capital needs and reduce their operating expenditures, but they have that option if they so choose. Under this bill, if they have no capital needs in a particular year, they simply sit on that money.
But in reality, a lot of districts that have even declining enrollments or static enrollments still have some significant capital needs. Isn't that true? For example, Lebanon School District has been trying to pass a levy for, I guess, 10 years to do some badly needed capital construction work on buildings that were built in 1910, 1920, haven't been able to come up with the money because they haven't been able to get local voter approval. wouldn't House Bill 3277 provide him a vehicle of funds to do that?
Chair Federley, Representative Witt, yes, it would, but they're welcome to use their operating revenues now if they choose to do that. What this bill would do was would give them, I mean, if they have, they're not in here, I believe they're in Linn County, so we don't have their data yet. If they have high exception value, then they'll be a beneficiary of this bill, and they will have more money than they would currently have, and would have an additional source of revenue for those capital needs. If they have low exception value, they end up as a loser under this bill.
Yeah, follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, but isn't it true that we don't want to see districts taking operating dollars that currently flow through the formula in an equal way and using it for capital construction needs because their operating budgets are tight?
Well, if we don't want to do that, then I mean, because the bill forces them to do that.
No, well, I have to disagree with that. And the reason I have to disagree is because the legislature determines how much money to appropriate for K-12. That money goes into the formula along with those local property taxes that are used for operating needs, and that determines what our ADMW funding is.
Well, if you're arguing that the legislature will completely backfill any of the money that this takes out and dedicates to capital, and I would agree with you, then the question becomes, is this the best way to allocate money to capital needs? And I would argue that it probably is not, for the reasons I've outlined here. We're in a sense mandating how much each district has for capital needs based on a measure of exception value, which I would argue is a very poor proxy for the needs of the district. I think you can see that in some of these examples here. Rainier, I mean, that's a nearly 6% exception value. We're telling them they must spend that much on capital when, in fact, their needs may be much less, they may be much more.
Of course, we don't know what Rainier's exception value is going to be over the course of the next 5 years should this bill pass.
That's correct. We don't know that.
Okay. Let's wrap this up. Thank you, Brian. My inclination is, I think this bill and HJR 46 have raised interesting issues to look at how the state can participate in some capital needs. My inclination is to put together a quick short-term focus work group here in the next week or so to work with the Treasurer's Office and maybe Lori Wimmer Whalen and Ozzy or somebody to look at capital funding issues between this and HJR 46 and some other options that are out there and see if we can't at least move the ball a few yards forward this session. So if members, as long as we don't have a quorum, on the work group are interested in participating, let me know. I'll be glad to schedule you in. The Treasurer's Office involved in that, too. Yeah.
I'm interested, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Bates. Brown. Okay, now we got to be careful. All right, I'll all right.
Wait, there he is.
All right, we are adjourned. Have a good weekend, everybody.